I've got something I want to say to you for the first few minutes of this little session, and I want you to listen to me, because what I'm going to do during the last half is going to so overshadow what I say that if you don't hear what I say, you'll forget it. So please listen to me to start with. Now you can't leave, okay? All right. But you got to hear what I'm going to say to start with, so that you'll understand what I'm going to do at the end of this thing. The pressing question of today is not, is there a God? The pressing question is, what kind of God is there? Now, I don't think any thinking person can be an atheist. There's too many intellectual evidences of God, too many intellectual evidences of a creator, of one who judges, of one who shows mercy, of one who fashions and forms, who determines eternity. Just listening to Dottie sing, knowing where she comes from, her background, that God would take a person like this and would give a little housewife down in Panama music like this that would come out of a heart. That doesn't come from training. That's a gift. God has placed something in a person's heart, and they write that down. And that's evidence of a creator. That's the creative gift at work. So our question is not, is there a God? Everyone knows there's a God. The questions are of a different nature. What kind of God is there out there? Is he personal or impersonal? Is he good or cruel? In short, can God be trusted? Can he be trusted with my life, with my future, with my health, with my money? Can I trust God that he'll not let me down if I give my money away? Can I trust God if I do the ridiculous in faith that he will respond in power? Can I trust him? Or is he the kind of God like the Jewish daddy who tells his little son to jump off the steps? And then when the son jumps and he steps back and the kid crashes onto the ground, he says, that's just to show you, you can't trust anyone. Is God like that? The more clearly we understand the nature of God, the more clearly we understand how we are to live. That's the reason that the task of God's people is to point people to God, not to teach them how to live. This last week, our home group has been in the mountains of North Georgia. Inspiring kind of thing that I used to recommend that all home groups take off for a week and have a vacation together. But now that I'm 52 years old and water fights have lost their excitement, especially when it's a wild psychologist with a space between his teeth standing over you in the middle of the night with a water pistol squirting you. Would you receive therapy from a man like that? Told you I'd get you back. Anyway, we had a good time. And Curry Vaughn's getting ready to go up to the same place in a couple of weeks with a group of people that are just as crazy as the folks that I just went with. And so he'll come back and will be full of testimony. it's good to go off. It's good to spend the time together. And we had five middle-aged couples who went off and forgot that we were middle-aged and played like we were teenagers and did things that we would punish our teenagers for. But one of the evenings while we were there,
We were up in Gene Barry's cabin up in the mountains of North Georgia, way up near the North Carolina border. One of the evenings while we were there, Gene and Jane had invited their friends, the Kirsches, over for dinner. Myra and Norman Kirsch live up there in the mountains. They're mountain people. And Norman does odd jobs, but he does odd jobs so that he can earn enough money to support himself, so that he can go out into the county jails and the lockups and the prisons and visit in behalf of the Lord Jesus Christ those whom the world has literally cast out as undesirables. That is his life's purpose of being there. And his work is just to earn enough money so that he can do that kind of thing. And they're precious people. And Norm and Myra belong to a little Baptist church up there in the mountains. She plays the organ. He sings in the choir. He says, we're there because God told us to be there. He said, we would not be there if God had not told us to be there, because it is dead, 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 lifeless. No life whatsoever. He said, people come in and they sit on old wooden pews and they scowl, and the preacher stands up and he scowls and everybody scowls, and they all say, haven't we had a good time at church today? And then they all go home, and he says, but we're there because God has put us there. And then Myra said something. She says, we exist on the tapes that come from the tabernacle. Now, they've never been here. To my knowledge, they've never attended a service here, but they know everybody. We had them for dinner, and it was though they were part of this fellowship. The tapes are just life to them, and they know Inez, and they know Jimmy Smith, and they know Sandra, and they know Claire Toy, and they know they now know Curry. They know everybody, and they call everybody by their first name. And it was a kind of an interesting occasion as they repeated back to us all the things that have been going on at the tabernacle across these years because of the tapes they receive. And then they take these tapes out into the jails and the prisons all over the place. In fact, I had a magnificent kind of experience. We went to a little kind of county fair on the 4th of July at Blairsville, Georgia. And I was walking through the little fort place that they, y'all know where all that is, don't you, that Woodard's doing. Somebody stopped me in the middle of the, Jamie Buckingham, I listened to the tapes from the tabernacle. And we had a joyful time out there with some mountain folks who were up there. The tapes have been passed around all through those hills up there. Well, anyway, at dinner that night, Myra Kirsch said something rather significant and rather moving. She said to me, you don't know what a marvelous thing you have down there at the tabernacle. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, you have taught those people how to love. She says, the world, the church, knows nothing about love. They don't know how to love each other. They don't care about loving each other. And the church is interested in stomping out sin, and world is interested in sinning. And said, you've taught those people how to love. And I've thought about that. I've been thinking about that over these last weeks since we've been back. And I thought, you know, I really haven't. I've been here now for 17 years from the opening day, which was held out at Wickham Park. And I've never preached on love. I've never used 1 Corinthians 13 as a text. Never done it. Never taught on love. I've never come to you and told you that you need to love one another. I've never come and told you how to love. I've never tried to define love. I don't think I can. A lot of things I just need to keep my mouth shut about. Love is one of them. And as I've examined that, I have not taught on love for two reasons. One of them is because I prefer to say with Thomas A'Kempis, It's better to practice it than it is to know how to define it. And so I have preferred to show love rather than to preach on it or to teach on it, to demonstrate it in my life, family, my ministry. The demonstrations are the things that you remember. Curry and I were talking yesterday. I took him out on the racquetball court and beat the fool out of him. And as we were... he says, liars won't get into heaven. Well, I did for one game anyway. We played several. But we were talking about the whole concept of preaching here at the Tabernacle. As Curry takes over the kind of the preaching segments here. And with the realization that people really don't remember much of what is said, unless you're the Kirsches and you live off of tapes, then that's a whole different situation. But most of you don't remember what is said. You can't, you may pick up a phrase or two. What you remember is a spirit. You remember an attitude. Or you remember a demonstration. If there is a demonstration of love, you remember that. Those are the things that register in our mind. Wasn't it Edgar Guest who said, I'd rather see a sermon? That's what he was talking about. I'd rather be one than to preach one. So you remember the demonstrations. The second reason that I've not taught on love or commanded you to love one another, preached on it, is because I have not come. I don't think my purpose here in Melbourne, my purpose at the Tabernacle Church, is to lead you to love one another. My purpose, my function here is to lead you to God. And then God will do the teaching. God will do the instructing. God will do the correcting. You see, so many of us have a misconception of who God is. We don't fully understand God. We don't understand who He is because we've picked up some kind of childhood concept that God leans over clouds with a billy club that's 2,000 miles long, looking for somebody that he can crack over the head. I see you down there. And we grow up with this kind of thing. I grew up, remember my Sunday school teacher talking about the all-seeing eye and showing me on the dollar bill. There's a big eyeball on the dollar bill. And they said, that's God's eye. I don't know where that eyeball came from. I've heard all kinds of weird things. Somebody said it came out of that pyramid that's sitting there. I don't know. And I'm not going to get into all of that anyway. Money's to be used anyway. But anyway, there's a big eyeball on the dollar bill. And my Sunday school teacher told me that was God's eyeball and that God was looking at me. Well, that's kind of terrifying when you're 7 years old and you've just learned how to smoke. And that God's got His eye on you. I mean, listen, I remember my mother catching me out behind the tool house. I didn't have cigarettes. I didn't know how to buy cigarettes. They wouldn't have sold them to a seven-year-old kid anyway. And so my friend had told me they need to smoke rabbit tobacco. Well, I didn't know that rabbit tobacco was a weed. I thought it was those little balls that we found on the ground. And so I crushed all that up and take one whiff of that, and my friend who was with me said, what's wrong? I said, I think I've just got cancer. Anyway, my mother caught me out behind the tool house, and she told me that the seeing eye of God had come around behind the tool house and was looking at me back there.
Remember, she brought me inside, and she said that my sin was too great to even pray about. Well, that was a bad situation. But anyway, we pick up these kind of childhood impressions of God, who just loves to stomp on little kids, and big kids too. And so now it's not smoking rabbit tobacco behind the tool house. Now it's a whole bunch of other things that we do, which are very, very bad. And so here comes God, and he's all eye and he's all foot. And the foot is used to stomp on you and to like a bug. Well, that'll teach you. You'll never do that again. And so we've picked up these concepts of who God is. And I have felt that my purpose, my task in being here, Curry and I have discussed this together. I think we're in accord on this, that our task is not to tell you how to live. Our task is not to accuse you of being bad. My goodness, your wife accuses you. Why should I accuse you? You know you're bad. My task is not to tell you that you're okay either. You're not okay. I'm not okay, you're not okay. That's the title of my new book. That's not my task. My task is to lead you to God. Is to bring God to you and say, here's God. Notice him, learn of him, love him, adore him, walk with him. And as you do that, God takes care of all the things in your life that are wrong, and you love him. And then he teaches you how to love others. I can't teach you. If I showed you how to love others, you'd do it the way I do. And that's gotten me in a lot of trouble. And I don't want you in that kind of trouble. I want you to love God the way God will teach you how to love. And so my task is to impart the Holy Spirit to you. I've based my life and ministry on the supposition that you don't need to be corrected by me or condemned or even instructed. God says, I will instruct you and teach you in the way that you should go. My task is to put you in touch with him, and that you would develop a relationship with him that would be so strong that even when there is no preacher or no teacher or no church, that he still instructs you and teaches you in the way that you should go and will guide you with his eye. He has an eye, but it's for guiding. It's not to beat the hell out of you with. Now, Richard Foster, in his latest book, says the more clearly you understand the nature of God, the more clearly you understand how to live. And thus the big question is this: what is God like? What is God like? Well, God's like Jesus. Or Jesus is like God. They're the same. They're one. They're together. That's what God is like. Well, how do I learn what Jesus is like? How do you learn of Jesus? Well, you learn of him through this book. This is the Jesus book. I think I remember that the symbol for of the blind, language for the blind, of the Bible is this. It's the nail prints in the hand. It's the book of the one who has the nail prints in his hand. This is the Jesus book. And so if you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you find out who Jesus is. Now, how do you learn of him? Well, Jesus tells us in Matthew 11 how you learn of him. Let me read you those verses. They're in the last two verses of Matthew 11. Matthew 11, verses 29 and 30. Verses 29 and 30. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest in your souls. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. How do you learn from him? By taking his yoke upon you. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Now, I learned to fly an airplane 20 years ago. And my instructor was an old Army basic training instructor who had been an alcoholic while he was teaching people how to fly back during World War II and had not sobered up until just a year before he got hold of me. So he still used alcoholic training tactics to teach people. For those of you who are pilots, you'll appreciate this, but we didn't use a radio. He said, I don't trust radios. And so I learned to fly without ever learning to use a radio. Still don't know how to use radio. And he said, we just don't use radios. You just kind of bluff your way into the field. And so you fly in and you pretend like you don't have a radio and they'll let you land. Well, they let you land, but they're terrible circumstances following that kind of situation. And anyway, he said, we never land on the runways. He says, the runways eat up the tires, so we landed on the grass next to the runway to save the tires on the airplane. So anyway, I had a good time learning how to fly, and I learned in an old Piper J3, which is also called a Piper Cub, which is a tandem seat airplane, one seat behind each other, had four instruments on the panel. It had a ball and bank and an altimeter and an airspeed and something else that didn't work, compass. Really didn't need the compass because you never got that far away from the airport because you always stayed within seeing distance of everything that was around. And then it had a stick and two rudder pedals and a little throttle over here on the left-hand side. And you kind of strapped the whole airplane on. You crawled into it and strapped the thing on, and you wore it is what you did. And so my instructor sat in the back seat, and I sat in the front. And he said, now sit up there. And he says, I'm going to teach you how to fly the airplane. And he says, the way you learn how to fly the airplane is you put the yoke on and you learn from me. He said, put your feet on the pedals and put your hand on the stick, put your hand on the throttle. And he says, follow me. And we were out there and I was suddenly flying that airplane. We took off down the runway and the stick went forward and the tail of the airplane went up. And then we went a little bit further down the runway and the stick came back and the airplane took off. And the left pedal went down and the airplane banked to the left and we straightened that thing back up and I just flew all over the sky. But I began to realize that my controls were attached to his controls. And then I wasn't doing anything. In fact, I could take my hands off the thing and it just flew just as well without me because the master was in the back seat flying that airplane. But he says, follow me through. Do everything that I do. Now, he says, if you tighten up on those controls, we're all in trouble. So he said, don't grab hold of the controls. Just follow it through very lightly. We were driving home last night after Ken Phillips' wedding and going down the road, and a big black dog jumped up in front of the car, and I hit the brakes and squealed. And my precious wife sitting next to me thought we were going to run into a pole alongside the road. So she helped me out on the driving. She reached over and grabbed hold of the steering wheel. Just straighten out of the car. We had quite a discussion. And I said to her, please don't take the steering wheel in emergency situations. She said, but I thought you were going to hit that pole over. I said, I was in control. I saw the pole. Don't touch the steering wheel. Anyway, learn to fly the airplane because the master was handling the controls. Learn of me. Now, this is what Jesus was talking about. If you want to learn the Christian life, then you do it by putting his yoke on. Paul called his Christian friends, his Christian brothers in Philippi, yoke fellows. People who had put on the yoke of Jesus Christ. And then, of course, there's that famous passage in 2 Corinthians 6 that we read about not being unequally yoked together. You're familiar with that. By the way, that's not a good translation of that passage. You may want to take a look at that for just a minute, and then I'm going to show you something. But 2 Corinthians 6:14. The King James Version, the King James Version says, "Do not be unequally yoked." Uses the term unequally yoked. The better translation from the Greek does not use the word unequally at all. It simply says, "Do not be yoked together with unbelievers. Do not enter into complicity with unbelievers." Now, I believe that that means don't enter into business arrangements whereby the unbeliever controls you. Don't enter into an arrangement with the bank where the bank controls you. Don't enter into a business partnership where the partnership controls you, where the unbelieving aspect of that. It does not mean don't associate with unbelievers. Of course you do. Nor does it not mean don't do business with unbelievers. Of course you do business with them. It does mean don't let them control your life. You as the believer are to be in the driver's seat. You are to be the one who's in control. Don't be yoked together with unbelievers. I also believe that that means in marriage that you do not marry a non-Christian. That you do not marry a non-Christian. Because if you read the rest of that passage, what do righteousness and wickedness have in common? Or what fellowship can light have with darkness? What harmony is there between Christ and Baal? What does a believer have in common with an unbeliever? Nothing. For we are the temple of the living God. As God has said, "I will live with them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. Therefore, come out from them, and be ye separate." Now, the concept of separateness is the concept of holiness. It's the word hagios. Separate, apart from. Be separate. Don't be yoked together. Because you see, in marriage, what happens in marriage is you literally become one. The whole concept of marriage is spiritual oneness. And what Paul is saying there is, how can you enter into spiritual oneness with someone who is not of the Spirit? You can't do it. So there can be no Christian marriage unless it's two Christians who are coming together. So the command of God is that you don't enter into a marriage state with an unbeliever. Now, very quickly, let me pause here for a second, because you'll say, what if I'm already yoked to an unbeliever? Well, I want to show you what to do with that. I'll show you what you do in that situation, because there's some of you who are already yoked, and you don't get out of that by divorcing the unbeliever. There's better ways to do it than that. So, okay, now I want to demonstrate something to you. This is a yoke. This is a yoke from the Far East. They also use them in the Middle East, but this is one from the Far East. And this is a beautiful piece of equipment which is extremely heavy. It's been varnished to civilize it and to keep the bugs on the inside of it rather than to let them get out. But this goes over the head of ox or cows. If you're in the Philippines, it would go over the head of a carabao or water buffalo. They have these things in Malaysia and Thailand, don't they? Okay. Anyway, it goes like that. And then your friend, the other ox, gets in the other side of this. And that's a yoke. Now, actually, they can't get their heads through there, so this thing comes out. Slips out, and they put it up underneath the neck, and then there's a hole here, and a pin goes through there, and that holds it in, and once it's in, and then you this big ring in the middle is attached to a plow back in the back, and the oxen or the carabao, the water buffalo, they pull the plow, and the farmer stands back there, and he guides the plow, and when he gets to a place where he wants to turn, he has a sharp stick, big long stick with a sharp point, and he pokes the ox in the tail. And the ox turns around and says, "Yes, sir." And he says, pokes him in the left, it means go to the left. Pokes him in the right, it means go to the right. That's called a goad. You remember what Jesus said to Paul on the road to Damascus? He says, Paul, how can you continue to kick against the goads or against the pricks? He says, that's what you've been doing. You've been trying to live your life not realizing that I, the farmer, am back there, and I'm going to keep poking at you until you just can't stand it any longer. And that's what happened to Paul. He finally fell down on the ground, and the Lord got hold of him, and he became a Christian. But anyway, that's beside the point. This is a yoke. And I asked Curry if he would come up here and demonstrate this with me. I want to show you some things. Curry played guard at West Point. And so, you know, he's bigger than I am. He's stronger than I am. And I'm a little smarter than he is, but evidenced by the fact that I got him to come up here. Yeah, okay. I want to show you something. Let me show you something here. No cameras, please. Uh-oh. Well, okay. Anyway. Oh, we're in it anyway.
Oh, my.
Okay, well, we're trapped in this. I want you to know that something special is going on here this morning. The left-hand ox is the dumb one's on the right side. The left one is the intelligent. The left seat in the airplane is the captain's seat, and the left-hand ox is the lead ox. And so you can see by where we are here, Curry's a little bit taller than I am. He's got muscles like Godzilla. He's big. He's strong. And he weighs 200 pounds, and I weigh a little less than that. Anyway, he's bigger and stronger than I am, and he's leading. Now, the concept of being yoked together, if I enter into a business deal with a bank who has $2 billion, and I want to go down and borrow $75 to pay for my wife's whatever, and I have to sign over something, then I have put myself in a position to where they can take that thing from me if I don't come up with money. Now, there's nothing wrong with that as long as what I sign over is not something that I can't do without. Therefore, I have to be very careful in my relationship with the bank that I don't put myself in a situation to where they control me. I owe my soul to Sun Banks or the company store or whoever else it may be. Same thing is true in marriage. If I enter into marriage with this unbeliever, see, I'm a sweet young thing. And I have fallen desperately in love with the Hulk who is here. And the Hulk is not a Christian. And I love Jesus with all of my heart. And I'm going to win him to the Lord after we get married. See, that's the whole idea. You know, he says, sure. He says, you know, let's get married in the church. I don't believe in Jesus, but I will get married in the church, and I'll even come to church with you every once in a while. And, well, will you accept Jesus? Well, marry me and we'll talk about that. And so I marry him. And suddenly I realize that he's an unbeliever. He's unrighteousness. He's wickedness because he is not the righteousness of Jesus Christ. I've got the righteousness of Jesus Christ in me. What do? I'm in bad trouble. I want to turn and go to church. Can't make it. He wants to stay home, stay in bed, watch television, read the funnies. And then he wants me to stay there with him. And I can't get out of it because I am yoked together with this unbeliever. I want to stop and pray, but I can't do it because he wants to keep going. So the whole concept is the idea of yoking. Now, before I get away from this, what do you do if you're already yoked to the Hulk and you accept Jesus or Jesus is your Lord? Well, I want you to see another yoke over here. I wear two yokes, if that's the case. And there's another yoke just like this that is yoked over here to Jesus. I'm yoked to Jesus, and I'm also yoked to my husband. I will not get out of this yoke, but I will be close to Jesus over here. And I will trust that as Jesus turns me, that somehow big Jesus will also turn the hook at the same time. But the turning point is me. I have to be the one who answers to Jesus. Now, that's just kind of beside the point. I just wanted to leave that there with you for those of you who are yoked to unbelievers in your marriage. The big point is this. What am I going to do when I am yoked to God? Now let's change it. No longer is he the Hulk. Now he's Jesus. And I have come along because Jesus said, take my yoke upon you and learn of me. How am I going to learn of him? I'm going to learn of him because suddenly I realize he's a lot bigger than I am. And wherever he wants to go, I go. Now I've got a choice of going here and staying here. But if God wants to go to the left, I have to go to the left. God wants to go to the right, and I want to go, I can't do it. I have to go wherever God wants to go. Now the secret to that is to learn how to stay in step with God. Because the yoke, Jesus says, is easy. Because he's bigger than I am, this yoke doesn't rest on my shoulders at all. It rests on his. There's no pain because all of the weight is on the shoulders of Jesus, on the shoulders of God. All I have to do is stay in position. Now, I can't get out of it because if I've got horns and big ears and I can't get my head out of this thing, because once you enter into a relationship with Jesus Christ, you're into it. That's the reason you ought to be very, very careful about entering into that relationship, because you enter into it, you can't get out of it. But once you're in it, all you have to do is to learn to walk with him. And then it's easy. My yoke is easy. The burden is light. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me. Follow my footsteps. As I go, so you go. And you'll, after a while, not even be aware of the fact that you're wearing this thing. Now, let me show you one other thing. Turn around this way, Craig. Let's say that God is going this way, and I decide that I would like to go that way. I see some pretty thing over there, and I would like to just pause for a minute. God, you go ahead, but I'm going to... Do you see what happens in that kind of... Have any of you ever been in a situation like that before? That's enough, Curry. We've all been in those kind of situations where God says, I am the one who is in charge, but I say, no, I'll do it my way. And invariably there is pain. Invariably there is hardship. Invariably there is great affliction. And we blame God. It's never God's fault. The sickness, the pain, the divorce, the separation, the affliction, those things are never God's fault. They're only because I am pulling against the yoke rather than walking with him in step and in harmony. We're to be yoked to Jesus. And I have discovered when I walk with God, my neck will not be chafed. My feet will not be sore. It'll never be a burden. I'll never have to be poked in the tail with the goad. Because when you're walking in step with God, the yoke is easy and the burden is light. Now the time will come. Isaiah says it beautifully. He says, although the Lord seems to give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, your teachers will be hidden no more. And with your own eyes, you will see them. And whether you turn to the right or turn to the left, your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way, walk you in it. I have determined in my life that I'm going to walk with God. I'm also determined that I'm going to be yoked with Jesus Christ. I'm yoked with some people here on this earth. I'm very careful about who I get into the yoke with. Curry and I prayed together for 4 years before he came to Melbourne, before we determined that we would be yoked together. We took a long time with that. Every once in a while, I'll enter into a relationship with somebody, and I want to check that person out very, very carefully before I get into any kind of relationship. I want them to check me out. I want to make sure that we're going in the same direction, because there's nothing worse than getting into a relationship that seems to be going, and all of a sudden you come to a split in the road, and one wants to go one way, and one wants to go the other, and you can't. Because of the yoke. So you need to learn to walk together. Amos said, can two walk together? Unless they be in harmony, unless they be in agreement with one another. Now, God is calling on us to walk in agreement with Jesus Christ. That's the call of God on our life. That's the reason I'm back to what I said from the very beginning. The only question we need to ask is, what kind of God is there? And I answer this morning by saying there's but one God, and that's the God of Jesus Christ. And we are called to take his yoke upon us and to learn of him. And that's what life is all about. Once we do that, all of the other questions are settled. I don't want to deal with the question of whether you're having trouble with your wife, or whether you're having trouble with your money, or whether you're having trouble with your automobile, or having trouble with your health. I want to deal with the question of what is your relationship with God. Because until that is taken care of, nothing else will come into harmony at all. And therefore, before we leave this morning, I want to take a minute and give you an opportunity to settle that relationship with God. Every once in a while, we pause here at the tabernacle to give you an opportunity to make a confession of faith. Jesus said in Matthew 10, just a chapter before he had this little discourse on the yoke, he said, if you confess me before men, I will confess you before my Father in heaven. If you confess me not before men, I can't confess you before my Father who is in heaven. Paul said in the 10th chapter of Romans, he said, if you believe in your heart that God has raised Jesus from the dead, and if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, you'll be saved. So it's belief in the heart and confession with the mouth. Some of you have not had the opportunity, or have not taken the opportunity, to publicly say, Jesus Christ is my Lord. And I want to give you that chance this morning. Just to stand up and to say, Jesus Christ is my Lord. Now, I don't want you to testify. This is not a testifying time. This is a commitment time. But I want to show you what you're going to be doing. Because when you say, Jesus Christ is my Lord, you're putting your head through this side of the yoke. That's what you're doing. He has already got his head through this side. And Lord means Lord. Lord means he's in charge. Lord means from this time, if he wants to go this way, you go that way. If he wants to go this way, you go this way. If he wants to stop, you stop. If he wants to speed up, you speed up. He wants you to love your wife or your husband, you love your wife or your husband. He wants you to stop drinking, you stop drinking. Whatever God says to you, you do. I'll not say it to you. God will say it to you. And you'll put your head through this side over here. And you'll be yoked with Jesus. That's a heavy yoke, unless Jesus is carrying the other side. But this you need to be aware of. You're already yoked to God. You're yoked to him because he created you. You didn't create yourself. You're already tied in with him. The problem is, you're going one way and he's going the other. I'm simply asking you this morning to turn around. Biblical word for that is repentance. Pull out from this side and come around and get in on this side. Walk with him in the yoke.